Welcome to the ISF Podcast. From the Information Security Forum, the leading authority on cyber, information security, and risk management. I'm Tavia Gilbert, and I'm excited to share today's special episode, the best of the ISF Podcast. Steve Durbin, ISF's Managing Director, and I are beginning our fifth year of production, and we are celebrating. We're on a mission to offer you more education, information, and inspiration than ever before. We have some incredible guests lined up for conversations with Steve this season. But before we introduce those episodes, we thought we'd take a listen back to some of the insightful guests who have joined us in past years. Let's start with Colonel Chris Hadfield, a decorated astronaut, engineer, and pilot known for serving as commander of the International Space Station. In this interview from last year, Steve and Colonel Hadfield discussed the need for constant retraining and assessment, preparing to fail, achieving goals despite seemingly impossible odds, and more.
How do we get organizations to adopt a more NASA-like, astronaut-like view on security? So accepting the fact that we are not perfect, that technology is moving at such a speed that people will use it in a way that perhaps they shouldn't use it and things will go wrong. And to see that as a much more positive, if you like, learning experience rather than negative.
I think a practical way to do that is what pilots and especially test pilots and astronauts do. And that is not only to have the training period and selection and then execution as part of your normal function, but also the debrief part. And a non-attributable debrief, so that when you finish something in your simulation, but then also when you execute it in reality, how do we squeeze every little bit of learning out of what we just simulated or what we just did, so that the next time someone executes it, they don't have to repeat the mistakes of the past? Mm-hmm. You have to build a corporate culture that doesn't just attribute blame to an individual, but instead recognizes that people are fallible and every machine will eventually fail. Every bit of software will eventually hang up. I mean, just drive a high energy proton through the hardware and it'll hang up your software, like happens on the space station all the time. And so knowing that people and machines and code are all fallible, then accept that. Stop looking to just blame someone, but actually look for using that as a positive. Make the learning process ready to accept the inevitability of failure. We call it going wrong. It's not going wrong, it's just going. Mm-hmm. You know, things fail, that's okay. You've made mistakes today, we all do it. And so the culture and the way we communicate it and the lack of blame, but more the overall goal of combined success, those are all things that we do in various industries, and they can be done with security professionals also. But it takes individual change, and then it takes that feeding into a corporate and leadership change that shifts what the norm is.
And last year, we also heard from cyberpsychologist Mary Aiken, who specializes in the impact of technology on human behavior. She discussed the difference between cyberspace and real life, whether or not humans are prepared for the cyber challenges we face, and cyber addiction.
Everything is connected. Mm-hmm. From the protocols that we use to advise and educate parents in terms of how their children interact with technology, all the way through to hardcore cybercriminal activity, it's connected. And the point at which we understand these connections, we can then start to inform how policymakers tackle these problems in terms of in a legislative context, in an educational context, in a sort of health and well-being interventative context. We're not thinking about the problems in a way that is going to be conducive to architecting good solutions. We need to think about these problems differently. We need to fundamentally rethink. We need to rethink the architecture of the internet. We need to rethink premises like anonymity online in a societal context. And that doesn't mean that we want to infringe on the right of privacy, but we have to create an internet, an environment, a cyberspace that is nurturing in a societal context. Otherwise, we're building a lot of problematic behavior for the future.
One of Steve's favorite interviews was with someone else deeply concerned for the future. Privacy expert Anne Kavoukian is the distinguished expert in residence of Ryerson University's Privacy by Design Center of Excellence. In fact, Dr. Kavoukian developed the concept of privacy by design and its later evolution, security by design. Dr. Kavoukian spoke with Steve about many areas of cybersecurity, including attracting and retaining talent.
One of the things that certainly I think is a big challenge is we bring younger people into the workforce. We train them effectively through schools, colleges, universities, that sharing of information, you know, collaborative working is the way to go. Then we put them into a work environment and we close all of that down because for whatever reason, you know, that is no longer appropriate. And so we're sending mixed messages. And for an organization to change is very, very difficult. And so I think we're going to enter into an era where we've got some of these sort of newer organizations that get it. And again, those that are going to struggle. And when we look at, you know, skill shortage and that kind of thing, for me, that really is a competitive differentiator. The ability to be able to have, you know, cross age groups collaborating effectively in your organization is, for me anyway, fundamental to business success going forward.
I couldn't agree more. And when I talk to businesses, I try to differentiate what information they should feel very free to share and collaborate and grow versus the protecting. So the distinction between personally identifiable data versus, you know, you've got a group of techies and they're working on machine learning and artificial intelligence, and you want them to share and collaborate, and that's how the brilliant ideas come forward. There's no problem there because you're not dealing with personal information. I put the walls up when the data are personally identifiable and linked to identifiable individuals. I always tell businesses, that's where your concerns have to be. And you can explain this to your employees, that you want collaboration. I always tell companies, get rid of the silos. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't have legal over here and policy here and tech over here, and they're not talking to each other. You have to have that kind of communication, because that also builds for much greater privacy, because then you can embed privacy up front into all of these operations in a way that they can understand it. But I make it clear, this will not impede your business interests, because that personally identifiable data often relates just to employees and certain aspects of their work. The actual material that you're working on, you want collaboration on that. And it's not that hard to do. Once I explain this to companies, they get it. And they say, so you're not talking about putting the walls up everywhere. Of course not. You want that kind of interaction to develop the brilliant ideas that will be forthcoming. You do it in a way that doesn't deal with personally identifiable data. It's not that hard.
Mm-hmm.
Steve also had a fruitful conversation with James Arroyo, director of the Ditchley Foundation, about the importance of relationship and aligned values, growing geostrategic tensions, and protecting your reputation, one of your organization's crown jewels.
And this complexity, of course, is not helped by the fact that we have extended supply chains. We share information with so many different individuals now. And you know, the days are long gone where you could say we had a network perimeter around our corporation that we could actually, you know, throw a fence up around and protect. So life is going to get more complex, as you point out. Any advice that you can give to boards of organizations who perhaps, you know, perhaps a board member's listening to this and he thinks, well, I wonder how we could sort of move into that space. How could we protect our reputation better?
Work with companies that share your values.
Right.
Not the one necessarily that's going to give you the cheapest deal. Because then if they're trying to protect the same thing, they want to be the company that stands for this and that aligns with what you stand for. That's the best starting point. Try and choose people who share your values, because then your protections will align.
That's an interesting way of looking at it, isn't it? Because now what you're saying is that, you know, you don't necessarily go with the lowest bidder, if you like. You have to take a much more holistic view on value. And you have to be working with people that are like-minded, that are going to be able to assure you that they're doing the right thing within the different context that you've just mentioned. And I think for a lot of people, certainly multinationals, certainly in certain parts of the world, that's a very difficult thing to do, because it is all about the bottom line.
It is, but the bottom line is going to be affected ultimately by the core of the company. So I'm not suggesting that you always have to do that, but if you have as this kind of guiding point, what is it we really need to protect? When it comes down to that, you really need to be aligned with other organizations that will take as much care as you do.
We have also had Christopher Friends on the podcast. Chris Friends is AVP of Information Security for Interfaith Medical Center and has worked to develop the hospital's information security program and infrastructure. He and Steve talked about how and why Interfaith implemented a zero-trust network security model, tips for getting business leaders on board with cybersecurity plans, overcoming the challenges of working with legacy devices, and more.
It will somewhat vary by industry, but I would definitely start with the risk assessment to identify what in your environment you actually need to secure, mm-hmm. what you need to put the emphasis on.
Okay. And then gradually build it from there. So you're not trying to sort of boil the ocean here. It's little bite-sized chunks that you're
basically, that's largely why we did it over the course of so many months, is we wanted to minimize breakage while at the same time protecting stuff. Because in the hospital, downtime is really not acceptable. So we had to be very careful actually deploying this.
Okay. I'm curious as well as to how did you sell the concept of this sort of 18-month program to the board of the hospital or whoever it is? I mean, who did you have to convince to be able to move down this road, first of all? Let's start there.
Did have to convince other executives on the hospital staff, but that's largely where the mock incident came in, because it actually concretely showed what the impact would be if we were to be hit with a ransomware attack.
Okay.
So it kind of is fairly convincing when you see that, yes, we have a lot of the standard controls in place, which was the network segmentation by department at the time, which is actually better than a lot of hospitals had back in 2015. Mm-hmm. But even so, it showed that the risk was really unacceptable because you couldn't afford to lose a whole department. The impact on patient care would be fairly disastrous.
Right. So effectively, you're creating a scenario that the business owners, if I could put it that way, can relate to.
Yes.
And so you're making the case that way. And then, of course, they can decide whether or not that's acceptable or not acceptable. And in this particular instance that you mentioned, clearly it wasn't acceptable to have that kind of of scenario. Okay. So I think that's probably quite a useful and indeed important takeaway for people listening to this, because very often I'm asked, where do I begin? How do I get the message across to the business? You know, from a security standpoint, I can understand that I need to be putting a security wrapper around certain devices, networks, and so on. But the challenge very often is how do you sell that up to the executives who perhaps haven't seen, you know, the potential downside. And so I think that's a really good insight there.
Yes, and that's always a challenge, because for any environment, but that's part of why being a good CISO also involves a lot of soft skills.
Right.
You need the ability to kind of teach and present and get people to understand your point of view and where you're coming from and what the risks actually are.
We're very pleased that our friend Reggie Butler will be back soon to follow up on his 2018 conversation with Steve. Reggie is a deeply respected motivational speaker, a corporate consultant, and an educator with over 30 years of experience in delivering transformative learning solutions within the private and corporate sectors. He shared his perspective on the pressure to perform at a high level, the priority of finding focus and clarity in messaging, finding the right cadence for optimal performance, and more.
Let me take it on to the next stage, because I'm thinking now about the kinds of organizations that are probably listening to this. Very many of them, no doubt, will be multinational.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be working with a variety of different teams,
yeah.
not all in the same location.
Mm.
So we've got some other complexity that's starting to come into the mix now, right?
Yeah.
How do we get that cadence, that rhythm that you've been talking about to work across multiple cultures, multiple time zones,
right.
multiple media in terms of communication?
Yeah, so there's... I'm going to use a term that's out in the diversity, equity, and inclusion spaces right now. It's this thing called cultural dexterity.
Right.
And it's a muscle people need to build in order to walk across geographic and national boundaries.
Right.
So if you think about that first, it's like, if I don't understand enough about the culture, I possibly can't be doing my best in service of that culture's norms.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take that and put that to the side, and you think about cultural dexterity as a skill,
mm-hmm.
what I wanted people to suggest and start to think about is the rhythm and the cadence that I put together with my team. If I am working with somebody that is virtual, that is an entirely different skill and technique. And there are lots of ways to manage expectations, which is really where people should be focusing their attention. If I'm working with you virtually, you're in another country in another time zone, what are the expectations for how involved we will be and what will we be doing at those times, whether they're on times, off times, peak times, whatever it is, we have to create that cadence in a virtual format.
Right.
And I'm going to move this just for a quick second into, you would never doubt, if it were someone in your family, how to adjust and adapt toward a different cadence.
Right.
If someone moved out of your home and they moved to another side of the globe, you would find a way mm-hmm. to virtually stay connected if you cared. And right. I tell people that in business all the time. If you're working with a virtual team, you have to care about them first. You have to know what they're working on before you can create the cadence. And I have sometimes people, they look and go, oh, well, I just need them to do their work. And I'm going, I know. But do you care about them? Because at that particular point, you would actually pay attention to what their most optimal times are and the kind of information they need from you versus guessing and then having to backstep or backpedal or repeat yourself 3 or 4 times. It's everything about proactive on the front end, creating the expectations that create the cadence.
We look forward to having Reggie back for an episode we'll share with you in December. Another friend of ISF is journalist and BBC correspondent Nick Witchell, who sat down with Steve for a conversation on emerging threats.
Steve, let's begin with the threat horizon, because that's what preoccupies so many people. Little reason for cheer, many reasons for concern. Is the risk not in danger of running out of control?
I think that would be a fair comment, Nick, because there is undoubtedly this feeling of it's all becoming a bit overwhelming. How can I possibly cope with it? But if we go back to one of the principles around the threat horizon is there to try to identify upcoming threats so that we are forewarned, forearmed, can do something about it. And what the ISF has always done with that threat horizon is try to pull out issues, yes, at the basic security level, but also then say, what does this actually mean from a business standpoint, and what does a business, an organization, need to do in order to avoid some of those threats, mitigate some of those risks?
I want to come back to that in a lot more detail in a moment, but you say forewarned is forearmed.
Yeah.
Part of the problem, surely, is that although we are forewarned, we are not forearming ourselves, and that is one of the major issues that we confront, isn't it?
It is. I think for too long, we've struggled from a security standpoint, I think, to be taken seriously. And so, again, what we have to do is to really demonstrate that threats relate to risk, that relate to the sorts of things that businesses need to deal with. Our ability from a business leader standpoint to grow market share, to protect our assets, to deliver shareholder value, to deliver value back to our employees, to provide an environment for them to succeed. And certainly in the latest threat horizon, which we call Physical and Digital Worlds Collide, then we're highlighting the fact this is becoming very much more difficult to do, yes, but actually is just so all-pervasive across society that we have no option but to do something about it.
And we wanted to share with you a bit of the conversation Steve had with Dartmouth College Professor of Computer Science, V.S. Subramanian, who spoke with Steve about artificial intelligence, nation-state terrorism, the skills shortage, and more.
Let's get back into AI in a little bit more detail here now. And I want really to get your views on one of the really big issues that is facing the cybersecurity industry in general, which is this lack of skills. Do you see AI really helping to plug that gap, or actually is it going to compound the issue even more because there's a lack of data scientists and people who really understand the technology?
I mean, let me start with a very simple statement. The number of people who understand either AI or cybersecurity or data science is certainly larger than the number who understand any one of those three.
Right.
Right? So that's, I think, one piece of good news.
Right.
I think AI is going to significantly accelerate the capabilities of cybersecurity. You know, again, let me give you some examples. You mentioned data science, Steve. So think about malware analysis.
Right.
You know, 15, 20 years ago, the way this was done was, you know, pieces of code would come in, people would have to look at them manually and go through every single piece of code that comes in and say, okay, this is good, this is malware.
Mm-hmm.
Today, a lot of that is done by machine learning algorithms.
Right.
And those algorithms have been trained to recognize, say, Android ransomware mm-hmm. as opposed to Android goodware. And so this does require people in machine learning, but you can see that this has significantly increased the number of samples of malware that are discovered every year. It has significantly increased the number of samples of executable files that mm-hmm. can be processed every year, all with the same resources as before.
Right.
So I think it not only is going to, but is already making a difference.
Our guest, Will Houston, a consultant for Egon Zehnder, advises and headhunts in the cybersecurity space. He and Steve met in the recording studio to discuss the skills shortage, the effect of a breach on a CISO's value and employability, and more.
One thing I do want to ask you is the perspective that hiring organizations, or indeed you and other firms like yours, have on a CISO or a senior security professional who's been through a breach and got let go.
Mm-hmm.
Good thing, bad thing?
It's really remarkable. I'd say not long ago, it was generally seen as a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're actually having clients say, we want somebody who's been through a breach.
Right.
And it makes perfect sense.
Of course.
And I think the most important thing, though, is not just if they've been through the breach, how did they handle it? What did they learn? You know, that's what I'll ask people when I'm first meeting them, because being able to tell that story makes a tremendous difference. And it's very compelling to a client, particularly clients that are frequently under attack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want somebody who can tell the story. Oh, no, I've seen this before. I know what mm-hmm. to do. So I think it's very important. It's not to minimize the fact that, you know, this is an interesting, I don't know if I would go so far to say unique, but definitely different in the sense that your head's on the chopping block
mm-hmm.
in a way that other positions might not be. But I would say that's even becoming less so. People realize that if there's going to be a breach, it doesn't necessarily mean that the CISO and the cybersecurity team weren't doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
It might, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. And so I think there's definitely a lot more tolerance. And I've frankly been pleased when clients say, no, I want somebody who's seen it. I want to hear how they handle it, what they learn from it, what they do different, if yeah. anything.
I mean, it's valuable experience, isn't it? That, yeah. you know, fortunately today, the majority of organizations haven't been through that. But I think there is this sword hanging over people that says, you know, come the day, we could be the victim of a breach too. And you really do want somebody running that department, I would suggest anyway, who has been there, who's done more than just work off the tabletops.
Right.
John Fisher also joined us in the studio. John is a managing director at Lifars and a former FBI agent. In Steve's conversation with John, they discussed current and future cyber threats, cooperating with law enforcement, and more.
One of the things that a lot of people talk about is this need for increased cooperation with law enforcement, for instance. So having now been on both sides of the fence, how do you think we can make that happen better, more effectively?
Yeah, that's something that I can't harp on enough. And I know that would be kind of expected from somebody coming out of government with experience in the FBI. However, having seen both sides of the coin now, I will say that cooperation is of utmost importance. Even the smallest organizations need to make the relationships with Homeland Security, with the FBI, with any local or state entities that have cybersecurity programs. And the reason for that is that they serve as large data aggregators,
mm-hmm.
and they put out intelligence products that help defend other networks. So you may have a very robust security program. You may be catching things. You may be stopping attacks or defending your network appropriately. That information needs to get passed on to the next company who maybe doesn't have the right resources to pay for sophisticated software or expensive threat intelligence programs. The FBI, the DHS, they offer free threat intelligence that the smaller CISOs can take advantage of and leverage. That information is all coming from, well, I wouldn't say all. A good amount of that information is coming from private sector collection. So
right.
when, you know, a company is mitigating a threat, they're passing on the indicators to the FBI through relationships through either an ISAC or through InfraGuard. And then that information is then getting passed over to the next company to help defend their network.
Right. So, you know, I'm a CISO of a small, mid-sized company, and I'm listening to this, and I think that's a great idea. How do I get hold of that information? What are the steps I need to take to reach out to the FBI or DHS?
So there are certainly national programs that are very well known. I mean, a quick search online can point you in the right direction for reaching out to the FBI or DHS. I can speak to the FBI a lot better just from having been there. But every field office has a cyber program. The bigger ones like New York, San Francisco, LA have more agents, analysts working on their cyber programs. But even the smaller offices that we have in the FBI all have some sort of cyber program. You need to get in touch with your local FBI office, and that can be something as simple as picking up the phone and calling them and saying, hey, I'm a CISO of a company in Jackson, Mississippi, and I would like to speak to somebody in the cyber program to figure out how we can develop a relationship. And the FBI is happy to field those phone calls.
Our final listen back is with Sherina Edwards, another fascinating guest on the ISF podcast. Just this year, at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, we spoke with Sherina, a partner at Quarles & Brady LLP in Chicago, Illinois, and an energy expert with solid regulatory experience. When Steve and Sharina spoke, they discussed the pressure on infrastructure due to the massive shift to working from home, the resulting cybersecurity concerns, and how regulatory challenges are evolving even by the hour.
We talk a lot about skill shortage. One of the things that I think the pandemic has really shone a light on is the fact that clearly, like everybody else, some security people will be falling ill or they'll be needing to self-isolate. What is it you think that these large utilities organizations are able to do to plug some of that skill shortage gap at the moment?
Well, I think that it's one of those things that it's an over period of time, right? Right now we're in a crisis, and right now this shortage, which has gone on for years and something that I think the industry has noticed for years, is only something that I think is spotlighted right now because of the urgent need of these, you know, IT professionals. But I think certainly skill sets, and I talked about in the beginning, you know, the more of a focus on operations technology, and skill sets for that particular portion of the industry are scarce, and ongoing learning must be part of any long-run security solution. You know, I think that as attackers become more skilled, and defenders in the same way need to keep up just as much, and organizations need to be planning for reality. And so unfortunately, we're in the right now, but they need to be focused on the tomorrow, right? They need to be finding people, and if they can't, training in-house expertise, you know, offering to put them through additional training programs, hiring new employees, and anticipating contracting needs if that's the case. But certainly, I think that organizations as a whole need to be beefing up and bulking up on their operations technology security, certainly. You want to make sure that you are well aware of what your team looks like and their commitment to be there, and that they understand, you know, that there's a path to elevation, because those types of things are really important. I think generally too, addressing cybersecurity requires expertise from control engineers and security specialists, and those people need to work together. And so where these skills are lacking, I think organizations may be unable to correctly evaluate solutions. So they need to figure out how they can figure out these missed opportunities. It's going to be, I think, a combination of, you know, the career fair and, you know, the college fairs, and really getting people and building them from the ground up. But also, like I said, looking at your existing team and trying to figure out who has a piece of what we need and how can we build upon that? Because as you mentioned, the scarcity is just a very real issue in the space, and it's not one that's getting any better, particularly as there's more and more vulnerability, which generally as time goes on and technology deepens and gets more sophisticated, this is an issue that you need even more people.
We hope you've enjoyed this retrospective of the Best of the ISF podcast. We are grateful to each and every guest we've had on the program over the last 4 years, and we are excited to begin again with the first season of our relaunched program focusing on leadership. Beginning with a conversation I had with Steve about his thoughts on leadership and how leaders can grow from good to great. Here's a preview of that conversation.
Has your perspective about what makes great leadership been influenced by what you yourself as leader have experienced over these last 6 months or so of the pandemic?
I think that what we've seen over the past 6 months, and I fear we will continue to see for some time to come, is a whole range of different emotions that people are going through, whether they be in the workplace or not. I think that people are confused. People are angry. People wish that there was an easy solution. People don't necessarily know all the time how they should be behaving, how they should be responding to the different messages that they're getting, for instance, around the pandemic, around staying safe, around, you know, returning to work, or a whole range of these things. And so I think that there is a general desire for some kind of consistent leadership in that space, whether you view that as being, you know, within a corporate environment, whether you view it as being politically, it doesn't really matter. I think people are looking for some kind of direction, some sort of North Star, if you like, that they could at least follow. And I think that we've seen a shocking inability at a number of levels to provide that form of leadership. If you think about some of the things I was talking about around, you know, good leadership, let's not even get close to great leadership. Let's just stick with good. You know, I talked about communication. I talked about the need to clearly communicate in a language that people can understand, that inspires them perhaps.
Steve and I hope that you will be inspired by the full conversation. and that you will be a fan and a subscriber to the refreshed ISF podcast. We invite you to tune in to our complete catalog of video and podcast episodes, all of which you can find at securityforum.org. You can subscribe to the audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd be grateful if you'd rate and recommend us. Growing our subscriber numbers helps us reach new audiences and helps us continue to bring you timely discussions such as the ones you've heard in today's Best Of special episode. You can always join in the conversation on our LinkedIn page, and you can get in touch directly through our website, where you can also download ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like the ones you've heard today. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox and Tavia Gilbert. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Assistant producer, Katie Flood. Mix and master by Brian Barney.